Good morning. Can you hear me at the back? Yes? Please say if you can't. I'm Anthony Cantlell, and I will be chairing today's event. I'm the sort of warm-up act for the main speakers. A very warm welcome to you all on behalf of the trustees of the Freud Museum, its acting director, Dawn Kemp, and the other staff of the museum to this conference on Freud and Wagner. Some practical details. There'll be two coffee breaks, mid-morning at about 11 a.m. We're running slightly late. Mid-afternoon at about 3:15 p.m. And the lunch break will be at 1:45. Please aim to be back here in good time for the afternoon session, please, so we can crack on. And I implore you to search your conscience if you were even for a moment considering staying only for the morning. Your afternoon speakers do need you. Now, whilst the title of today's conference is concerned, amongst other things, with the end of myth, there is nothing mythical about the need of London's small museums to raise sufficient money to ensure the survival of their work, and the Freud Museum is no exception. Today's conference is just one example of the many fundraising initiatives that the museum has organised this year, so your presence here today is very welcome, as is our appreciation for the generosity of all the speakers today in waiving their fees. I hope this doesn't come as a surprise to any of them. If you haven't already joined, do please consider the very good value of spending £35 and becoming a friend of the Freud Museum. And if you've time this weekend, do please try to visit this historically important and most interesting building, just 5 minutes' walk away from here. Personally, I think it's better than the one in Vienna. Now, whilst Freud himself often worked on a Saturday, I'm having an opportunity this morning to leave my day job as a psychoanalyst, and in particular the daily prism of the consulting room, and to pursue another of my interests, the world of music, and in particular today, 200 years after his birth in 1813, the man and the music that is Richard Wagner. 43 years after Wagner's birth saw the arrival of Sigmund Freud, whose titanic mind and reputation, unlike the ship of the same name, most certainly didn't sink, and who instead, as the most famous archaeologist of the mind, so indelibly left his mark on the history of ideas and changed forever the way we think about the unconscious and its vicissitudes. Now, a brief word about your participation in the discussions as they unfold during the day. We have roving microphones for this purpose so we can all hear your contribution, and it would be helpful, because it's being recorded, if you would say your name and what you do. In the planning of the event today, my colleagues at the Freud Museum were most keen that the atmosphere of the day should be conducive to discussions characterised by what they called tolerance and intellectual grace rather than academic point scoring. Translated, this means, I think, that we might strive to make room for both the inhibited and the outspoken amongst us. For example, some of you here today, like myself, will not be musicologists and steeped in musical academia, or musicians or performers, or even be able to read a score, but instead enthusiastic appreciators of the fabulous vistas of unparalleled experience offered by the world of music. Some of you will, in addition to your love of music, also be involved in the fields of medicine, psychology, psychotherapy, and psychoanalysis, or training to do so. And then there are our speakers today, sharing with us their erudition, and widely spread it is too, across such a wide range of topics. But for all of us, whatever our knowledge and our perspectives about Freud and Wagner, about psychoanalysis and music, whether we call ourselves Freudians or Wagnerians, or both, or not at all, or just love being curious about today's conference themes, I hope we can manage to enjoy listening to each other and contributing to making the day feel worthwhile and stimulating. To remain musical for a moment longer, can I say that in sketching out this introduction to our day together, this miniature overture to the day's very varied programme, written and orchestrated by the museum's deputy director, Ivan Ward, and the tremendous contribution of his friend and colleague, Stephen G., I've been asked to say a few words by way of introduction to the day, and for this purpose, I will try to keep in mind the story of the newly qualified priest who went to his bishop and asked him what should his very first sermon be about, to which the bishop replied, "About God in about 10 minutes. So bear with me, please, not too much longer to go. I was wondering how to divide my comments this morning and my time between the two creative giants that are Freud and Wagner. And although hardly a very sound basis for the differentiation, I decided that as Freud had already got his statue downstairs in the grounds of the Tavistock, and that once upon a time this clinic here used to reflect Freud's thinking rather more enthusiastically than it can nowadays, I'd compensate in Wagner's favour and simply give more airtime to the firstborn male. Which, if you knew anything about my older brother, you'd see how successful my own analysis had been. Given that this is the bicentenary year, my aspiration to keep my task topical hasn't been difficult. This year's BBC Proms series featured Wagner's work, performances worldwide of his operas continue, and our very own Simon Callow's outstanding performance in his one-man show, Inside Wagner's Head, at the Royal Opera House, and which ends tonight, has for once left critics and audiences more or less united. Last month's Moral Maze, BBC's Moral Maze programme, was given over to considering whether art can be morally contaminating, and whether we should be very much more discerning in our enjoyment of music composed by a man who described the Jews as the born enemy of pure humanity and everything noble about it. Wagner's own essay in 1850, Judaism in Music, is certainly a most repugnant document, yet it was written by the same man who gave us those sublime closing chords of resolution and hope at the end of Götterdämmerung. The Moral Maze programme sought to explore whether those moved by Wagner's music are in some way morally compromised, and can we, it asked, ever separate the beauty of art from the sin of the artist? Now, with such thoughts possibly around in the minds of those gathered here today, it's unlikely that we will reach 5 p.m. without inevitably having to visit the reality of there being no myth at all regarding Wagner's pathological antisemitism. As you will know, this continues to generate considerable discussion and remains, of course, a highly contentious and viscerally sensitive matter in relation to performances of his work in Israel. What personally troubles me about this endless debate is the way in which Wagner is too easily seen as having the monopoly when it comes to evincing deeply offensive attitudes and beliefs, some of which will have been colonised and manipulated by others half a century later in the Nazification of German culture. Because someone writes quintessentially the most epic of operas and bestows a lasting legacy to us all that defied the limitations of what musically and dramatically had gone before, and in so doing defined the shape of things to come, doesn't mean for a moment that they are in any way free of flaws or exempt from projecting these characteristics into others and identifying and attacking such features as if originating only beyond themselves. It would, I think, be a pity if our discussions today were eclipsed by this more notorious aspect of Wagner. For my own part, I find the perspective-retaining position of the Cambridge academic George Steiner very helpful when he says, and I'm quoting, "How can you have amongst the highest achievements of beauty or speculative elegance and audacity of the human mind and conscience and guts and viscera on the one hand and the awfulness on the other? Wagner's music, as they say in a law court, is Exhibit A. My own conviction is that people like ourselves, perfectly ordinary people, cannot grasp what is going on in the mind of a titanically complex creator who created Parsifal and then says absolute barbaric inhumanities. So I say that the man who has given us what he has, musically, lies outside my range of understanding. That doesn't mean it doesn't make me bitterly, bitterly disturbed, ill at ease, but to put it very vulgarly, that is my problem, not his. End of quote. Now, the things said about Wagner and his life and music range from the fascinatingly erudite to the trivial. The conductor, Sir Roger Norrington, when asked about Wagner's music, said that he could never imagine Wagner writing music, but he could imagine him running a company or an airline. Comments and complaints about the lengths of Wagner's operas are universal, but just try getting tickets for one of them. For example, someone once quipped that the trouble with Wagner is that his operas start at 6 o'clock, and after 2 hours you look at your watch and find it's only 6:20. Actually, somewhat related to this issue of length, I shamefully admit to taking my 8-year-old daughter to a performance of Parsifal at the ENO. Of course, in this audience in particular, I can hardly conceal from you the narcissism that this portrays, made salutary by her reminding me, very benignly, 30 years later, as we stood outside Sadler's Wells last weekend, that child abuse takes many forms. I mentioned George Steiner a moment ago, and another, this time Max Steiner, who composed the music for the film King Kong, has suggested that Wagner was the real template for the invention of film music, and certainly I think many would agree that the dramatic tension Wagner achieves through the brilliance of his music has offered generations of film composers those magically inspired moments we can all remember. I don't know whether our Wagner scholars here today would agree with me, but I often think that the Wagnerian leitmotif device is all around us through television advertising, those ubiquitous electronic drums that herald the start of EastEnders, and for those of you unfamiliar with the genre, that's the programme where the problems of allegedly ordinary people in East London are eclipsed by the fact that they keep shouting at each other. And of course the unmistakable signature of John Barry on the Bond movies, and the sheer sense of terrifying menace that is the amalgam of bassoon, horns, double bass and percussion given to us by John Williams in his famous score for the film Jaws. I should, of course, come back now to say something briefly about the other name on today's conference programme. Freud, like Wagner, managed to upset a lot of people, and still does. But like the popularity of tickets for a Wagner performance, there's no shortage of people wishing to pursue the study of Freud's ideas and those of the clinicians and thinkers who have gone on to develop further his core theories around the centrality and primacy of the unconscious in everyday life. He warned us all of our enduring capacity for self-deception and reminded us that whatever the sophisticated and civilized captain on the bridge thought about the direction of travel, the death instinct in the engine room might have quite a different destination in mind. His radical thinking that gave children sexual thoughts and curiosity was, for its time, profoundly challenging and highly contentious. Like Wagner, he spent his life composing and organizing his ideas, which in turn have offered us important navigational aids when entering the portals of the troubled mind, so that we might better understand the theatre of conflict that arises from the condition we call being human. I think it's fair to say that Freud was rather more an appreciator of the visual arts, and maybe the kindest way of putting it is to say that Freud had Van Gogh's ear for music. Freud himself claimed not to be able to carry a tune. His daughter Anna reported that he never went to concerts. We do know, however, that he liked some operas, particularly Mozart's Don Giovanni, A Magic Flute, and he enjoyed Wagner's Flying Dutchman and the Meistersingers. But suffice to say that if he were alive today, he wouldn't be a regular customer for music from Emerson. Also, like Wagner, Freud had his own problems and wasn't, in his dealings, always very nice or easy to have around. He bestowed to us the seminal and groundbreaking Interpretation of Dreams, and yet his wife and children might at times have found living with him something of a nightmare. Our speakers today will be looking at how Freud and Wagner might well have been drilling from opposite sides of the same mountain, whilst using very different equipment and techniques. To my own mind, the representation of the unconscious, reflected in the music of Wagner, and the joining together of this with the description and understanding of the unconscious found in the writings of Freud, offers us the prospect of a most interesting marriage of ideas. Or if I can end with creating my own brief libretto to accompany an equally brief piece of mythology, whereby if Wagner proposed to Freud a collaborative union of creativity, he might simply have whispered, "With this ring I thee wed." Thank you.